to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 65, otherwise known as season 4, episode 8. And I am your host, James J. Edwards. And with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How are you doing, Jacob?
Doing great. I'm fully vaxxed and getting ready to see my first movie in theaters in over a year.
Yes, I'm fully vaxxed as well. And the first thing I thought was, I'm going to see A Quiet Place Part 2 in a theater, damn it. Awesome. How do you feel? Did you have any side effects?
Oh, yeah, no. Like, after the second shot, I just felt like hot garbage for like a day or two.
I was fine that afternoon, but then the next day, I felt like... it felt like a hangover without the nausea. It was headache, fever, the chills.
Yeah, no, I had them flu-like symptoms, and I was so physically weak. Like, I was having trouble going up and down the stairs, but it didn't last that long, and, you know, like, I feel great now.
That's your body, I guess, learning how to fight it. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's good to have a mild case like that. And if that was a mild case, oh, I don't ever want to have it.
Yeah, no.
Also with us yet again is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, Correa?
Doing well. I'm also fully vaxxed at this
nice.
Point.
Nice. Well, you did the one and done.
Yeah.
Johnson & Johnson.
We have the three of us. I did Pfizer, Jacob did Moderna, and Correa did Johnson & Johnson. So if you have any questions about any of the American vax options, we're your guys. We can answer. We got all three bases covered.
It was funny, too, because my partner, Lindsay, she got her one and done the day prior. So like, I got to get a preview of what was to come because she felt like crap that whole first day, like the rest of the day into it. So I was like, oh, man, this is going to suck. I get my shot the rest of the day. I'm just like, I'll admit, I was being a dick and I was running around the house working out and stuff, being like, I feel great. This shot didn't do anything to me. Next morning, down. I was down for the count. Everything was sore. I felt like shit. I was like, she still felt like crap. And that at that point, it was like day three for her. But by like the evening, I was fine. So I feel like a prick because I was kind of rubbing it in her face how it didn't hit me as hard.
It passed for me by about 6 p.m. the next day, it hit me hard. I was like, oh, this is crap. But hey, you know, now I know that my body can fight it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We missed an episode, and it is entirely my fault because until podcasting pays the bills, I have to work at this other company that does web streaming, and I quarterback the international streaming of the Grand Slam of Curling. So, not only is that why we missed an episode, that's why I don't have anything to talk about as far as what I watch. I can tell you that Bruce Moat won both the Men's Champions Cup and Players Championship.
Yeah, he did.
Good to know.
Rachel Homan won the Women's Champions Cup and Carrie Anderson won the Women's Players Champ. But as far as any new movies that come out, I got nothing. So what have you guys been watching?
Well, Joe Bob Briggs is back with The Last Drive-In. So I've been watching a bunch of those episodes every Friday. And they've been pretty fun. And also he's been doing guest stars. Like the first night he had Eli Roth and they did the original Mother's Day and House by the Cemetery. And on Friday, April 30th, they had Jeffrey Combs and did Bride of Reanimator and this Australian horror movie called Next of Kin. So it's been pretty fun.
Next of Kin is so good.
Yeah, I'd never seen it before, but it was pretty unsettling. Like there was some pretty good scares in there.
Is Ship to Shore doing the Next of Kin soundtrack? I feel like I saw a targeted ad.
If they do, that's a day one buy for me.
Oh yeah, because it's the dude from Tangerine Dream.
It's the guy from Tangerine. So, I think it is Next of Kin. I remember seeing that because I actually went and did a little shopping on Ship to Shore yesterday, and it just popped up like, and it wasn't there the day before. So I think that Ship to Shore is doing it. It's pricey. It's like $40.
Worth it.
Wow.
It's a great soundtrack.
Yeah. I mean, an exceptional soundtrack.
Yeah. Did you guys see In the Earth yet? Ben Wheatley?
Yes. Film? I saw it at the drive-in.
Same. Oh, it's.
Yeah.
That's definitely one movie. I always recommend going in as blind as possible with movies. But with this one, I knew nothing about it except it was Ben Wheatley and it was shot and kind of takes place during a pandemic. And that's all you should know going into it. It's absolutely phenomenal. What'd you think, Jacob?
I loved it. I like to equate it to this movie is to director Ben Whatley what Phenomena was to Dario Argento, because this feels like an encapsulation of all his work, as it has all his kind of styles and tones in one movie. You got like the folk horror stuff, you got the pitch black comedy stuff, you got like the surrealism and trippiness. So I mean this in the best way, it does kind of feel like it's got elements of like Sightseers and Field in England and Kill List all kind of wrapped up together. But it's really well done, and it's very interesting because he shot it during the pandemic, and it kind of fits into the plot.
Yeah, it's a big part of the plot, especially in the beginning.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And they shot it like not early, but like mid, like over the summer, last summer, I think. So yeah, it's incredible. Not only were they able to do that safely, but like actually make like a really, really good movie with it too.
Oh yeah. So.
Because like we've seen a bunch of movies come out that were shot over the pandemic, and let's be honest, a lot of them were not good. It's like not worth risking.
I want to ask you guys that. Do you think the stuff that comes out over the pandemic, and I'm not talking about stuff that they just risk shooting, but like things like Host, where the pandemic actually plays a major plot point, mm-hmm. or the TV show This Is Us is leaning hard into the pandemic so much so that, you know, they talk about temperature checks and, you know, and they wear masks everywhere they go and they're talking about vaccination stuff. Do you think this stuff is going to look dated in about 5 years, or are people going to remember, holy crap, we lost a year of our lives to this pandemic? I'm struggling with, I don't know if this stuff's going to stand up, if it's a mistake that these, you know, that shows like This Is Us are leaning into the pandemic. And I know they're trying to be responsible. They're trying to say, hey, it's cool to wear a mask in public.
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, it depends. Like, I've definitely seen some stuff like the Blacklist doing that really crappy animation for their last like episode or so, that already hasn't aged well at all. They couldn't finish their season. So they hired like a storyboarding company to do the animation for their last episode. It did not look good. I don't think stuff like that's going to age well, but I mean, there's some shows like, there was this, drag show on HBO Max that I got really into, and they couldn't finish their season because they were filming it when the pandemic hit. So they ended up doing like a retrospective on the lives of the hosts and stuff. And it was a very emotional and very well done episode. And it came out like early pandemic. So it hit really hard because here they are talking about how this finding this community saved their lives. And now no one has that community because it's mid pandemic. So I think stuff like that is going to age well, as long as it's good and the message is still there. I think anything can be timeless. I think anything that as the things that don't age well is pop culture references. Shrek is not going to be, and Shrek and the Shrek sequels especially, they're not going to be as timeless as a Pixar movie because it dates itself very hard, you know?
True.
I think that the media that's being produced right now, it's going to be a time capsule of this pandemic for better and worse. So, you know, you're going to look back on it, and, you know, if you're going to look back on a movie like Host, and you're going to remember, you're going to say, oh, yeah, that did happen. You know, and Host is an amazing movie. I love that.
Yeah. I think it just stands on its own.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. Cause it's not like a huge crutch they use. I mean, it's like, yeah, this is why they have to do this seance over Zoom, but you know, it's not, you know, it's not gimmicky. It doesn't feel good. Yeah. It's organic.
And same with in the Earth. Cause a lot of the stuff where they function within the pandemic works well for the plot, and it's pretty realistic. Cause it's a lot of the procedures that we were doing, you know, at that time. So it is time capsule-y, but it works really well with the story. So I think it'll function on both levels.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me.
Cool. What else you guys been seeing?
Did you guys see the new Mortal Kombat?
Not yet. Although I'm actually going to see it in IMAX today.
Ooh, in IMAX.
I'm fully vaxxed, and I even renewed my A-list, so I'm going to go up to the Universal AMC and see it in laser IMAX and experience a theatrical experience for the first time in over a year.
You're going to double mask though, right?
Oh yeah, no. I'm going to be fully masked. I'm going to be very careful. Yep, double masked.
2K95s.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm still going to wear a mask wherever I go to, because not it's for other people's peace of mind.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah. You know, I can carry around my card this time vaxxed all I want, but I'm not going to be that dick. You know, I'm going to be like, you know, hey, if it's going to make everyone else in the theater more confident that I have a mask on, I'll wear a mask. You know, I'm not that asshole.
Oh yeah. No. I was totally planning on wearing a double mask. Like my technique is KN95 mask and then my Jason Voorhees mask.
There you go.
because it's all about style.
Yeah. It's more of a fashion choice than a practical one. Look, at that point,
you know, if there's one good thing to come out of this pandemic, is that I can just go around wearing a Jason Voorhees mask in public.
You're just getting your money's worth out of that fucking mask, man.
Oh yeah.
It's the biggest and like loudest thing. I remember when you first bought it, I was like, man, is he going to get much use out of that? Cause like this thing might only last like a couple of months and it's just going to sit on his wall or something. But here we are, like we're over a year later and you're getting your fucking money's worth out.
Oh yeah.
You're assuming he's going to stop wearing it when this thing's over. He's going to keep wearing that thing.
It's my God-given right to wear a Jason Voorhees mask for the public health.
And not only that, but you also wear your Giallo black leather gloves too. Like at least the times when I've like come over to drop off stuff, like you come out wearing both, and it's just like, are you like an amalgamation of horror?
Well, I mean, I did that more at the beginning because, you know, just I remember everybody was more like, oh, you should wear gloves too. But I guess it's not as big a deal now, so I don't really wear them as much. But I did wear the gloves for a while, but you know, I was using what I had handy, you know. I was doing what I could.
I saw you also finally got an autograph too, right?
Oh yeah, well actually that was that I had bought that initially, like is like if you paid extra, Tom Savini autographed the mask. So like I got one that's not autographed and I got one that is autographed.
Oh, you got a second one that's autographed?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, because I remember you paid for the autograph, and when it came in it didn't have it, so you got two now. All right, so
yeah, no, I got two masks.
All right, one for you know, everyday use, and one for, you know, special occasions, I guess.
Exactly,
right? We're going to the MoMA this weekend. Make sure you wear your autographed Jason Voorhees mask.
Oh yes, of course. But yeah, no, I'm excited to see Mortal Kombat, and I'm especially excited to be able to see it in IMAX. Although I do regret missing Godzilla versus Kong in IMAX, but yeah, the drive-in experience for that was still pretty awesome. So, you know, I'm not too disappointed.
It, just seeing it on the big screen was worth it. Even,
oh, you, yeah.
Like, I know we sometimes say, even at the drive-in, the drive-in's still good quality stuff. As long as you have decent speakers in your car, it's still
a great
experience. Have you guys heard of Russian Raid?
I have not. No.
It's a Russian movie, obviously, and it's inspired by The Raid, Redemption.
So it's not just a clever name.
No, it is clever. And let me tell you something. This movie has me inspired. I hope every country does their own version of The Raid, because this is not a straight up remake. It's literally just its name. It is a Russian raid, and it is the most Russian thing possible. it's about this group. This guy hires this group of thugs and this ex-military sniper guy to raid a Russian vodka factory in like a stronghold takeover from the Russian mob.
That's the most Russian thing to raid.
Oh, it is. And the guy and the thugs that they hire all wear tracksuits.
Oh wow!
Because why wouldn't they?
Well, because it's the Russian raid. And of course, eventually the KGB get involved, and but most of the fighting is MMA style. Like they purposely put it in the plot, like there's going to be no guns. So like for a good portion of the movie, it's just straight up MMA fighting. It is so ridiculous. It's not as good as the Raid movies, but it's fun for what it is. And what it is the most Russian fucking movie that they could have possibly made. Like,
is it campy fun, or is it like actually a good action movie? Like, how is the stunt? You know, the stunt performing, and I mean, is it good, or is it like so bad it's good?
No, when the action happens, the action is good. It gets it, you. I definitely got exhausted by the third act where I was just like, all right, I'm kind of getting over this. But it was a fun time. Like, especially if you're a fan of the Raid movies, it's worth checking out. I really hope that that we start seeing, like, you know, German Raid or Japanese Raid.
Canada Raid.
I want to see Canadian Raid.
They go, yeah. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's just a lot. And like, they raid a maple syrup factory and have to fight a moose or something. I don't know. And the Mounties come in.
And they're fighting with hockey sticks.
And curling. They
use hockey sticks and curling brooms. Curling is actually a Scottish sport that Canada embraced.
Oh,
that makes sense.
Yeah, I can see that.
I'm full of nuggets like this. Just ask me anything.
That checks, because a lot of Scottish sports are about moving really large or heavy objects. So it makes sense that they would have one where it's like, yeah, we're going to move it on ice.
And the guy who won both the tournaments that I did, the men's champion, Bruce Moat, his team is from Scotland. So not only did it originate there, they can still curl.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Let's move on to our guest, because we really want to talk to him.
Yeah.
So we have a very special guest this episode. We've got with us today composer Charlie Clauser. How you doing, Charlie?
Good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Doing well.
Yeah.
Charlie is the composer behind all of the Saw movies, among other things. But his newest project is Spiral from the Book of Saw. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about everything, but we want to talk about that especially. So how you doing, Charlie?
Good, man.
Let's start with the typical questions. How'd you get started in music? People are born with it.
No, but like, you know, most people when they're growing up, like have an older brother or a cousin or something that turns them on to like Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin or whatever. And I didn't. And my parents were kind of older. They were born in 1930. So there was a lot of music around the house, but it was all like Dixieland jazz and Scott Joplin ragtime and stuff like that. And it wasn't until I bought two records at a yard sale for 25 cents each. I think when I must have been in about third grade, and one was David Live, which was David Bowie live at the Tower in Philadelphia. That was a double album from his sort of Thin White Duke era. And the other was Led Zeppelin One. And I bought them both because of the cool artwork on the cover. And of course, that blows any third grader's mind coming home with those two records, because I had always played instruments and never practiced them. So like any typical elementary school student, you know, take clarinet lessons for a year and never practice and then give it up, and then take guitar lessons for a year and never practice and give it up. But by the time I was in about third grade, I was playing the drums, and that stuck. So that was the only instrument that I stuck with through high school and through elementary school and high school.
And you're an original member of Nine Inch Nails.
Well, quasi original. I joined in 94, so which was kind of in the middle of the touring cycle on the back of the Downward Spiral album.
Okay.
James Woolley was one of the original keyboard players, and about halfway through that tour, he was just over it, and so I had been on the road with Nine Inch Nails, kind of doing studio stuff and operating and manhandling the hotel room studio rigs that we would set up whenever we could. And then eventually, you know, Trent was like, okay, you're up. And I had never actually played, even though I was a synthesizer jockey and computer geek and drum machine fiend and all that, I had never actually played keyboards in front of people before, until my first gig with Nine Inch Nails, which was, I think, New Year's Eve, 94, I think. And 22,000 people, something like that.
Wow. Did you do the tour that Nine Inch Nails did with Marilyn Manson opening and the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow?
That was the one. Yeah.
Okay. That was your first tour. I saw that tour. And then I saw one before that with Typo Negative opening. But okay. So one thing about Nine Inch Nails that always blew me away, and you might be able to shed some light on this, at the end of their shows, there's no equipment left intact on stage. Complete carnage everywhere. Mm-hmm. Did you have techs, or maybe it was you before you started playing in the band, did you have techs that had to repair all that stuff, or did you just go buy new stuff?
Well, we had an army of techs. and, you know, each band member had their own dedicated tech. And of course there was a crew of, there was a stage manager and a stage carpenter and so on. So they could do things in a pinch, like build a little stand so that when Robin Fink kicked his guitar cabinet and it fell over backwards, it wouldn't fall on the jack and break off the jack. So they would, you know, the stage carpenter could build a little trestle that it would fall back and hit on. But we did have an army of techs, and we used all the keyboards on stage, even though we'd break two or three a night. They were all the original brown metal Yamaha DX7 synths from the 80s, which is a cheesy and corny sounding thing. And we all secretly felt we were doing a duty to society by taking as many of them out of commission as possible. But that wasn't the reason we used them. They were everywhere. You could find them in any pawn shop for $300, and there would always be one at the local music store. And they were made of metal, so they could really take a beating. Parts were available, so if you needed one key, because a key had snapped off, you could get them. And they could be waterproofed fairly easily. You could open them up, wrap things in saran wrap, put silicone caulk in there and close it up, because Trent would come around with his water bottle and squirt your keyboard and try to disable it or cause some catastrophic electrical malfunction. We used those pretty much exclusively. But the main thing was that, you know, they were available everywhere, and you could bring one home from the pawn shop or guitar center or wherever and just stick it on stage and plug it in. And it didn't need to be programmed or set up or have the channels changed or any. So they were ready to go right out of the box. So
it was a combination of repairs and just buying a new one.
They were just ubiquitous. We would carry we had these big trunks that held six each. So we'd try to carry 12 at any given time.
Cause those shows were, I mean, it was like a catharsis, but I mean, and you guys wouldn't just like, you know, snap a jack off. I mean, the keys would be strewn about the stage. I mean, they would be destroyed, you know, drums kicked over.
Well, and it was cool the way that Trent laid out the set, where we'd play sort of the first half of the set and things would get more and more insane, and we'd wind up playing the song Happiness and Slavery, which was just a total rodeo roundup, as we call it. He would go around and lasso people with his mic cable, and everything just gets destroyed. And the drum kit gets flipped off the riser and keyboards are flying. And then that movie screen would come down for the three song quiet section in the middle, and that would allow all the stagehands to basically rebuild the entire setup behind the curtain.
I remember the mic cable lassoing, because I was wondering if the guitar player would ever get pissed, because Trent would run around him and then pull and he would fall. It would trip him. Yeah. And I'm like, is he ever get pissed? I mean, he's basically tripping him and making him,
you know, pull. At that point you're so caught up in the moment. You're like, that was what really attracted me to their, you know, joining the live bands. I wanted it to be maximum violence and chaos and fist fights between band members and just utterly out of hand, out of control. That, you know, and some of our favorite gigs were when we'd play smaller venues where there wasn't room for that security barrier where, you know, they have a metal barricade and then like a gap where there's a bunch of yellow shirt guys standing. But when you play in a smaller venue, there's not room for that. So now the punters can get up on the stage. Yeah. And now they can come and try to steal the cymbal stand off the drum kit or whatever. So those were always the most fun, was when it was just completely unhinged, because the set was laid out in such a way that even if a guitar broke or a mic broke or something, the music would still go on. And we weren't persnickety about, oh, you messed up my solo, man. You know, there was none of that attitude. It was really all about the cathartic, violent mayhem.
Yeah, the time I saw you guys with Typo Negative, it was in a tiny little place like that. Mm-hmm. It was on the campus of SDSU. I think it was Montezuma Hall. And then with Marilyn Manson, it was at the San Diego Sports Arena, and there were the Yellow Jackets. But the Montezuma Hall show was much more fun. I mean, it was... Right. Yeah, you're like you say, it's boil, 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 explode.
And when there's a sense of risk that something bad might actually happen, that's kind of more, feels more visceral and more real than when there's five guys beating the heck out of each other and their instruments, but there's a bunch of Yellow Jacket guys standing in the barricade and the audience can't participate. It's kind of more fun when all the techs and roadies have to come out and stand along the monitor, the wedge monitors, and start pushing people back into the pit because they're bum rushing the stage. Like, that was always our favorite kind of gig.
Oh, I miss those type of shows. Yeah. It's been a while.
Old for them good now, times. But yeah, those are good. Okay, enough talk about Nine Inch Nails. How did you get into, we'll probably come back to it, I'm sure, but how did you get into film scoring?
Well, actually, when I was in college, I studied electronic music, which this was in the era before MIDI keyboards and everything. So electronic music in those days meant a giant ARP synthesizer the size of a refrigerator and a bunch of four-track reel-to-reel machines. It was old school academic electronic music, making tape loops and, BBC radiophonic workshop type of loops and bleeps.
Quarter-inch plugs, like a switchboard.
Exactly. And after college... And the kind of music I was always into was like Brian Eno and Roxy Music and kind of, sort of more on the art rock side of things. You know, and a couple of albums that I really fell in love with in my formative years was the David Byrne and Brian Eno collaboration, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
Oh, that's a great album.
Which was just a mind blower because it sounds nowadays you could put something like that together with samplers and with Ableton Live and all that, but they did it completely manually with analog equipment and tape machines. And there was another David Byrne album that Eno also collaborated with him on that was Byrne's score to the Twyla Tharp dance recital called The Catherine Wheel, which was another great album with all kinds of wacky sound design and instrumental tracks. And all the heavy hitters of the art rock era were involved, like Adrian Belew and people from the Talking Heads kind of extended universe. When I moved to New York after college, this would have been 85, right after MIDI and computers started to come on the scene. Of course, it was absolutely crude. We're talking like Commodore 64 computers and like the old original Macintosh. Remember the little one with the little screen like this? And for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, I actually had a real job for a minute, which was working at the Sam Ash Music Store on 48th Street in Manhattan. Back in the day when if you wanted to find out what the hot new sampler or drum machine was, you had to physically go to 48th Street. All the music stores were right there on this one half of a block area. And you had to go there you couldn't just look it up on the internet. And I kind of became sort of the computer and sequencer guru at the store where there'd be, a line of people waiting for me to show up half an hour late to work every day. But one of my customers there was an Australian record producer turned film composer who would come over twice a year to buy whatever the cool new goodies were to take back with him to Australia. And in about sometime in 86, he hired me off the floor at the store to be the third man in his three-man operation, scoring the final season of the CBS TV series, The Equalizer, which now is like they have movies and they've rebooted the series and everything. But that series, the old version of that series, had been scored by Stuart Copeland from The Police. And he was, I guess he had to leave the show to go do a police tour or something. So this Australian guy took over and hired me to do like the sound design and program all the sounds for the synths and kind of be the hands on the rig. And so that was great because I got to see how how the sausage gets made is the cliche phrase. And to see what was involved in the workflow and the terminology and just how does one do it? And of course, that's a path that a lot of composers take is they'll be an assistant or an apprentice or an intern or whatever to an established composer. So they can see how it goes without it being their name on the line, and that this all happened before I got involved in making records and doing, White Zombie and Nine Inch Nails and all that kind of stuff, which was a 15-year detour. But when I came back, when I left Nine Inch Nails in 2001 and came back to L.A., I actually reunited with that same composer and we scored a TV show. And then the phone rang and it was the Saw movie and we were off to the races.
And what was was there a connection with the makers of Saw, the reason behind you getting that call?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit diagonal because... I have this music business lawyer that I'd worked with for, at that point, my entire career, 15 years or so. Up till that point, most of what he had done would be like to organize the contracts for a White Zombie remix or something like that. Right. And usually I usually talk to him once a year. It's usually on my birthday. And I can usually hear like waves crashing at his Santa Barbara estate, you know, and steak sizzling on the grill in the background and ice cubes tinkling in the highball glass. And so he called me like on a Wednesday, nowhere near my birthday one year. And he said, Charlie, I need you got a pencil, take down this number. You need to call these guys right now. They have a horror movie. And this, I was already involved and I already scored some TV and stuff, just getting back into it. But at the moment, at that point in time, I was actually recording vocals for a Helmet album at my house. And so my wife says, you know, call these guys right away. They have this horror movie. They've got a whole lot of industrial music in their score. They don't want like a thematic orchestral horror score. They want like crazy crushing industrial music. You need to call them right away. So I did. Drove down and watched the rough cut of the movie at like, you know, 11 in the morning while I'm still sort of choking on my Egg McMuffin watching these gory scenes. And it was on and they were like, okay, we need to do this right away. We have about 5 weeks. Can you do it? And I was like, you bet I can. You know, and at the time, I remember at one point, you know, when you're working on a lot of projects, you know that you know when you've done good work and you think you have something great, but you never know if a project is going to find an audience, you know, whether it's an album or a movie, you're never really sure until it's out there on the street. And I remember at one point, James Wan, as we were finishing it up, said, look, if this thing winds up going straight to home video, I promise I'll rent a movie theater so we can all see our name on the big screen at least once in life. Of course, things turned out very differently for both for the Saw franchise and for James Wan, who's had a fantastic career, and Lee Whannell too, they were writing partners, and Lee, of course, is in the first Saw movie. So it was a risk at first, but it didn't feel like a risk once the thing found its audience and found its legs and was up and running.
Yeah, because like we said earlier, you've scored every single Saw movie. You're the connecting link.
That's the one, nine who's, so oh, far.
Well, also other James Wan stuff. I mean, like Death Sentence and mm-hmm. Dead Silence.
Yeah.
So which those scores to me are, like you said, the Saw movies are basically industrial pieces.
It kind of is its own thing.
Yeah. You know? But the other stuff, you basically done all of James Wan's stuff that wasn't done by Joe Bishara or isn't called Aquaman, I guess. Right. So, I mean, there's clearly a difference. Those are more subtle scores, whereas the Saw scores kind of, it's like a Mack truck.
It's full on. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the there's not much that's difficult about the Saw scores for me because it is kind of right down my alley. But the thing I have to kind of keep reminding myself of is that, you know, you can't really just repeat, and you have to up the ante. Every trap scene needs to be bigger and more insane and more just utterly bonkers than the one before it. So that's, if there is a challenge, that's the challenge.
Yeah. And I was going to ask what your process was initially with coming with the score. And I also wanted to ask specifically about probably one of the most infamous tracks from the score, Hello Zep, which has been in every movie. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
That, you know, we did have, James is really great because he's able to keep a zoomed out view of the conceptual approach to how to make things work both visually and with the score. And, you know, when we were starting on the first Saw movie, the concept that we kind of mutually agreed upon in the space of like an hour of talking was that it sort of, you know, that score is kind of different to many of the others, but it starts off a little bit light and almost curious, like, hey, what's in the box? What are we doing in this weird dungeon? And then it gets darker and heavier and thicker, and the root notes and the chords are moving downwards through the whole movie, and it gets murkier and muddier and more underwater sounding until in the final act, the score has just dissolved into basically banging on pots and pans and metal scraping and screeching. And it's just this unholy music has gone out the window, and it just turned into this, you know, Einstürzende Neubauten version of a score. And then at the crucial moment when Lee Whannell's character Adam picks up the tape, they find one more tape and he picks it up and he pushes play. That was, we wanted the score to feel as though like the lights just got switched on and it's bright lights shining in the audience's face. And so for that Hello Zep piece of music, it's in a different key than anything else in the movie. And the sounds are very sort of dry and kind of bright and strident. You know, there's that little string quartet kind of going, hang, hang. And it's very, there was nothing like that in the previous, you know, hour and a half of the film. And that was very much a conscious decision to make this huge tonal shift. But at the same time, that during that whole segment, there's a voiceover that's sort of narrating the twist ending. And there's lots of quick cuts of visual elements taking you to flashback scenes or alternate angles of scenes that you had seen earlier in the movie, but with the alternate angle, now more is explained. So there's a lot of information being conveyed, like kind of rapid fire through that whole ending montage. So I knew that the piece of music couldn't be, it had to sort of be compact. And it had to not distract the audience from paying attention to this narration and all these quick visual cuts. So it wanted to be strong and strident and insistent, but it couldn't be like some wandering flowery piece of melody. It needed to be just this little nugget of musical information that then kind of the phrases sort of repeat and build and change octaves, but it's not something that's going to be, that's going to require too much attention on the part of the audience. So all of that was a conscious kind of game plan. And when you have a game plan like that kind of laid out ahead of time, then it's, you know, my analogy is that that's like a coloring book. Instead of a blank sheet of paper, you have an outline of, you know, a clown riding a tricycle or whatever. So now you, all you have to do is decide whether the clown's nose should be green or orange, but the lines are defined and the parameters are defined, and it makes the job of filling it in musically that much easier.
And it's so iconic. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Brie from our other, from our sister podcast, Murmurs from the Morgue. I told her that we were interviewing you today, and she said she, growing up, she's younger than all of us, but she watched Saw movies every night, and there were nights where she couldn't fall asleep without hearing that before going to bed. So
nice to know that it did some damage, you know.
Well, they reuse that whole montage, different angle thing. That's mm-hmm. basically at the end of every Saw movie where they explain the twist.
Right.
So, I mean, they definitely got mileage out of, you know, that coloring book page.
And it's sort of become like a signal to the audience of like when that little like jangly little dulcimer part at the beginning of Hello Zep starts up, then it's like, okay, everybody.
Yeah.
Pencils down.
School's in session.
Pay attention.
We are going to explain everything to you now. We're showing.
Pay attention. Yeah.
And usually I hate when movies do that. I hate when movies tell you verbally. I hate it when they insult your intelligence. But the way the Saw movies do it, they do it visually as well. So they're like, oh, here's this angle. Oh, I missed that. So it works a lot better, I think.
Exactly. And it's very crafty on the part of James and the various other directors that have rotated in and out. You know, once that was established as the sort of the modus operandi in the first one, then they kind of have license to continue with that idea and it's very tricky sometimes how they'll, you know, the scene that appears earlier in the movie appears then in the ending montage flashback, but it's 9 frames longer. So you see just a little bit more and, you know, other alternate angles and stuff. It's a good reason I'm not a filmmaker, because every time I see one of those ending montages, I'm like, that was very clever. I never would have thought of that.
Now, you have a Spiral Book of Saw coming out, which is from the moment it was announced, it's supposed to be very different, because I actually marathoned all the Saw movies and the sequels are very similar. They stick to the formula, like they everyone does their own take with it and they do different stuff, but there's a formula. And everything about Spiral is sounding like it's breaking that formula, and it still has like the key elements and everything, but it's doing stuff different. How was your approach with that changed?
Well, I thought it was really, I mean, first of all, it was amazing to hear that, to get the call from the producers and they're going, you know, you're not going to believe this, but Chris Rock came to us with a whole concept for how to re-envision the franchise, to take it kind of down a side street a little bit. And he's going to be massively involved. Oh, and by the way, Sam Jackson's in it as well. And I was like, first of all, I'm on board for a Saw movie anyway, no matter what. But when I heard that, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. This is fantastic. And what they've been able to do is, you know, unlike most Saw movies, because like the first one was its own little weird thing. Then the second one was another kind of weird little detour. And then sort of three through X became kind of the they got more into the traps and like the sense of desperation of this year's batch of victims. And this time around with Spiral, unlike many of the other Saw movies, there's scenes that actually take place outdoors. And some of them are even in daylight, which like is not the Saw mode. You know, it's always dark and underground in some rusty, dank bathroom or something. And it really centers around, you know, Chris Rock's character and Sam Jackson's character. It is not sort of divorced from the Saw reality. Some of the, you know, a lot of the what the audience looks for in a Saw movie is definitely there, but it's a different kind of flavor of both visually and just the pacing of the thing. And, you know, it's not Chris Rock's performance in this thing is very much not Eddie Murphy in 48 Hours or Beverly Hills Cop. It's not him cracking wise as everybody else is playing it straight. He's playing it dead straight. And I always love when you see an actor who you might know for one genre kind of moving completely outside of what you'd expect, you know, whether it's Adam Sandler in like Uncut Gems, was that that was the movie where he played? Or I remember this scene in that Woody Allen movie with Kate Blanchett, where Andrew Dice Clay had a really small role as like the ex-husband of one of the actors. And it was, you know, I love seeing actors move outside what you predict that they're going to do next. And in this, it's great to see Chris like at the end of his rope. His character definitely gets to the end of his rope in this film. But because so much of it takes place not in some dungeon somewhere, that meant that it needed a kind of a different approach to the soundscape of the score. And, you know, a lot of times when I'm picking the sounds I'm going to use or picking the chords that the strings are going to play or whatever it might be, a lot of my internal sort of reasoning is this sounds like daytime or nighttime, or this sounds like indoors versus outdoors. And, you know, so many of the sounds that have become a part of the Saw like sonic palette sound like it's dark and you're underground and everything's murky and reverby. And so a lot of those kind of things just wouldn't feel right in a different setting. So there was a lot of course, as the movie draws to a close, things take a familiar turn to some degree sonically. And yes, we do hear some of our favorite Saw hits, but the whole front chunk of the movie all the way up until the final act is very much different to the texture and just the approach musically. So there's sounds that are percussive and bright and sharp and perky, if for lack of a better word, that would never fly in any of the other sequels. So it was refreshing to keep things in the dark and evil and heavy mode, but not have it be you know, a rinse and repeat of so much of the previous scores.
Do you have a songwriter's credit on the 21 Savage song?
Oh, yeah.
That's coming right. I would hope so.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, that it's really cool. What, I mean, this kind of got derailed a little bit by COVID, but when the movie was originally supposed to come out basically a year ago. And of course, lockdown, you know, the world went into lockdown something like 4 or 5 weeks before the original release date. And what was so going to happen was 21 Savage was going to be headlining at Coachella, and they had this whole live production where he was going to roll out the song with projections behind him with using clips from the movie. And it was going to be this whole like integrated synergistic marketing reality where he explodes onto stage with Saw paraphernalia and Saw videos behind him. And then the next week, the movie came out. Well, thanks to COVID, that didn't exactly go as planned. But the tracks that he and some of his other artists that he collaborates with did for the soundtrack album, which also appear in the movie in various spots, Some of them use samples from earlier Saw scores. 21 Savage's track does sample the Hello Zep theme and kind of flips it. You know, he takes a little chunk of it and then like tweaks it. So it was super cool to see, because I know that there have been like, you know, if you get on YouTube, you type in Hello Zep Trap Remix. There's, you know, a playlist of dozens of illegal, unsanctioned versions. But it was cool to see. And the producers were super on board with this. They were like, hell yeah. So it's very cool to see that material like find a new life out there in the world.
Do you, when you see all of those unauthorized remixes, does that piss you off or are you flattered? Do you think it's, you know, it's, hey, go ahead, do what you want with it?
You know, on the one hand, it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to play whack-a-mole all day long with the YouTube copyright strike thing. But it would piss me off more if, because the scores are technically a work for hire that the master is, well, it's co-owned. I do have a good deal with him, but I am not the sole controller of those mechanical copyrights. So I actually cannot issue copyright strikes on those. That's up to Lionsgate Films and Twisted Pictures. And maybe they have a whole, you know, a whole floor of an office building somewhere of guys hammering away, issuing copyright strikes. But again, it's like playing whack-a-mole. You can never shut that stuff down. I mean, it's like, and I'm gratified to find that people want to do that stuff. It's better than having them ignore it. And it's not like it's, you know, it's not like I'm going to miss my cell phone payment because somebody illegally remixed it, you know? So God bless them. More power to them. Enjoy, everyone. And it's like when, you know, this is part of why I was so wholeheartedly transitioned away from making records into scoring, because, you know, right around 99, 2000, 2001, my last couple of years with Nine Inch Nails, that was right when, I mean, of course, this was before iTunes, before iPods, if you can imagine, prehistoric, but Napster and LimeWire did exist. And you remember back then, Lars Ulrich from Metallica got all kinds of hassle because he was coming out against Napster. And all the fans are like, come on, you zillionaire with your art collection and your supercar collection. How dare you? I'm working Hot Topic, man. I can't afford to buy your new album. Like, how dare you tell us we can't download this stuff? And then somebody showed me exactly how Napster and LimeWire work, and I was like, that's it, it's a wrap, it's over. Because I've been broke like a joke, and I definitely would have been on Napster back in college if it had existed. So I kind of, you know, I realized that the whole economy that I came up in the music business, where you spend 2 years making an album and untold millions of dollars of the record company's money making these records, I knew that economy, it would still exist for bands like Metallica, U2, Foo Fighters, you know, bands at the AAA list. But there's going to be this weird hollowing out in the middle, because a lot of the records I made weren't like, you know, they didn't set the world on fire. Bands like Helmet, which is an awesome indie metal band. They have a solid audience and they're still going, and they're going to be touring with Ministry and Front 242 this fall.
Oh, nice.
But a lot of those bands, because they weren't, you know, U2 or Metallica, they relied heavily on record company financial support to make the kind of records that we made back in the day when you had to, you know, lock out a studio for 2 months in order to get your drums tracked. So I knew there was going to be some teething pains in the record industry that I knew and loved. And at the time, the scoring side of things was still relatively a safer bet, because people hadn't quite figured out yet how to BitTorrent the latest season of Game of Thrones or whatever. So it was, although they have caught up to that as well.
Yeah. The industry has definitely changed. And I think that artists are relying less on record sales and more on tours and merch sales, which COVID took that away from them.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's why they're all struggling now. If there's a silver lining to Spiral's release date getting pushed for a year, it's because there was a Shudder original called Spiral that came out about this time of year. Are you familiar with that movie?
No.
Oh, yeah. It's just called Spiral. It's about a same-sex couple that moves to this little redneck town and they get terrorized. It's a Shudder original. So because there's a year space between those, you guys won't, I mean, not that anybody's going to confuse a Saw movie with this, but you know, same title, Spiral.
I'm surprised at some at the quality of some of the horror stuff that I'm finding on alternative outlets that are, you know, on Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, et cetera, like that. And my wife's watching this one series called Black Spot, which I believe is a French production that's on Netflix. And it's almost like a Twin Peaks, Wayward Pines kind of weird little mountain town where strange shit happens in the woods kind of thing. And like the quality, it's a little weird because it's originally done in French and then dubbed in English, which is, you know, a little lopsided, but the quality of the writing and the, you know, it's like that show Black Mirror, which was such a hit. Again, that was kind of outside of the normal like channels for horror, but it was so good. And I'm pleasantly surprised at the quality of the stuff that's outside of the mainstream.
You bring up Wayward Pines. Tell us about some of the other things you've done in your career besides Saw movies. You know, like Wayward Pines was one of your themes, correct?
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was an odd little show. And when I signed on to do it, basically it was on the strength of, you know, they said, hey, it's Matt Dillon, Juliette Lewis, Terrence Howard, Melissa Leo, Toby Jones. I was like, I'm on. You stop right there. I'm on board, because those are my favorite kind of actors. They're maybe not the triple A list people, but they have a real interesting character. I mean, Terrence Howard's fantastic. That dude's just riveting when he's on the screen. And you know, Matt Dillon and Juliette Lewis. I love all of those actors. So I was 100% on board. And you know, the first episode is sort of, this might be a Twin Peaks type of show where it's like this weird little town in the mountains and everybody's in on something, but you're not quite sure what. And of course, it turns out it's the storyline across two seasons involves hibernation pods and traveling 4,000 years into the future. And I mean, it's this whole, you know, the mutation of humanity into mutant creatures. None of that is apparent in the first couple of episodes. So again, it was a cool way that they sort of lured you in with this seductive little environment that they built, and then they flip that on you with a brutal twist in the storyline. So, but it was a fun project because the first few episodes, the score is just sort of very small little sounds. There's no epic war drums. There's no, you know, World War Z zombies climbing the wall kind of music. It's all like little guitar feedback sounds and just weird little brain fart music, as I call it, because Matt Dillon has a head injury and you're not sure if what he's seeing is real or not. Then, of course, later we roll out the big guns and the epic war drums and the hordes of zombies climbing the wall and the whole thing. But it was an interest. It was fun to do something that didn't have a twist like a Saw movie, but it had a sort of a red herring. It lured you down one path and then said, oh, by the way, did we mention?
What about American Horror Story?
Yeah, that's very industrial.
Oh yeah. That's an iconic theme.
And that, you know, it's such a such a weird and circular path that resulted in that theme. And you remember the movie Seven, which,
oh yeah,
everybody must remember that movie. One of my
favorites. What's in the box?
Exactly. But the opening titles to that had a piece of Nine Inch Nails music that was a remix of the song Closer, done by Peter Christopherson of Coil. And it bears no resemblance to the original song. It's basically like some snippets of Trent's vocal manipulated and then a track that Peter Christopherson did. But it's this really atmospheric and dark, grinding sounding soundscape. And that was used in the main titles for Seven. So 20 years, and at that, when that movie came out, there was a young guy named Cesar Davila Irizarry, who's my writing partner on the American Horror Story theme. He came home from the theater after seeing that movie and hearing that Nine Inch Nails remix in the opening credits. And he sat down behind his probably a beige Dell Pentium computer, like with the gooseneck mic that you used to get for free, you know, and his copy of Cool Edit Pro, which was like a 4-track audio editor. And he created this weird little piece of music. He made some samples by taking a handful of coat hangers and dropping them on the tile floor in a bathroom and then time stretching it by like 1,000% to turn it into those chainsaw kind of textures that are in that piece of music. Those. And so he had a great time making this little piece of music and then put it on his shelf, and 20 years go by. And when Ryan Murphy is getting together to do the first season of American Horror Story, his instructions to the picture editing crew and to the second unit were, I want it to feel like the main titles from Seven, where it has this dark kind of, there's scratchy writing and there's, you know, weird pictures lit by candlelight and so forth. And I want the soundscape to be like that as well. One of the picture editors was friends with Caesar. Caesar had also had then by that point moved into doing visual effects and working on picture editing teams. One of the picture editors on American Horror Story said, you know, I have this piece of music that was done as a sort of reaction to the closer remix that's in the beginning of Seven. Let's use that as a temp track and we can edit our images to that. That's what they did. And of course, Ryan Murphy and everybody else involved fell in love with it, but it was just a scratchy stereo MP3. They didn't have the individual tracks. They didn't have the stems and the splits and everything. All they had was the mix. And so they came to me and they said, okay, so you were involved in Nine Inch Nails. Maybe you can, this is what we had temped in there. It sounds really cool, but we need like something. The mix is a little wonky and lopsided and we need to build out a better version. And so I took a few swings at it, four swings, in fact, trying to write a new piece of music from scratch that had that spirit, but didn't use any of Caesar's material. And they kept going, you know, there's just something about Caesar's original demo from 20 years ago that we all just love. So what we wound up doing in the end was I used like audio forensics tools to extract the parts that we liked from Caesar's track, those chainsaw noises and this weird little like psh, 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 kind of sounds like a hi-hat, but it's actually sample of water coming out of a faucet. I was able to extract these little molecules of audio and then use them as the raw material to build a new track, which very much resembles Caesar's track from 20 years ago, but is a more modern version with all the stems and splits and the mixing capability that we needed. And so that long circular track of it started as being inspired by Seven. Then they got me because I had had some peripheral involvement with that 20 years earlier. And it went right back around to Caesar's original track. So, and the various composers first, I believe it's Steve Levine and then later Matt Quayle, who have scored the show. Each year they kind of do a new, they flip the version of the theme. They'll take my original stems and add some new elements, keep the foundation of the thing, but add a new kind of layer on top that reflects what this season's theme of the show will be. Like for the carnival episode, the carnival season, they had like this weird sort of calliope steampunk kind of circus organ thing that they overdub. So it's proved to be a very versatile chassis upon which they can build each year.
And on some of your other projects, I was interested in asking about how you became involved in and how you worked on the soundtrack for The Collection.
Ooh. That was, you know, Marcus Dunstan was one of the writers in the Saw franchise, and he and I have done a few collaborations together. One was The Collection, and one was this little movie that he had, you know, a script he had had under his pillow since high school or whatever, called The Neighbor, which was just, he was like, can you do me a solid, man? I've got it together to make this movie. It's not going to set the world on fire, but I got to do it and get it out of my system. And it turned out to be this really cool little movie about hillbilly meth dealers, and these people move in next door, and the people you think are bad are not the ones who are bad. And it starred Bill Engvall, who is, you know, like one of the blue collar comedy guys.
Yeah.
But again, much like Chris Rock in Spiral, not playing, he's playing it dead straight and playing a white trash, oaky, really bad person. So that was kind of, that was a cool movie that Marcus, who had directed the Collection and The Collector, that he and I collaborated on. And I liked, you know, probably coincidentally, the first movie, Collector, was scored by Jerome Dillon, who was the drummer in Nine Inch Nails during the the tour during the second half of my tenure there. So, and I loved what he did. It was very dark and atmospheric and just really cool. So another small world moment.
It's all connected.
Mm-hmm.
What is, what's next for you? What, you got anything on deck?
There's a couple things that, there's a series kicking around and, a couple of other, I'm going to do my first documentary over the summer, which is a weird, I've never done that before. It should, hopefully it'll be less hair pulling than a Saw movie with 8 trap scenes, but it's a cool, it's still not set in stone yet, but the topic is a really interesting angle on social upheaval that occurred in recent decades and how a certain cultural movement influenced that and helped to resolve this weird cultural conflict. And it was an angle I'd never thought of, but as it's explained through the documentary, it's sort of like, oh, that makes complete sense. I can't believe I never thought of that angle on things. So that should be interesting and hopefully won't sap my energy too much with epic industrial beatdowns. And I would predict that the world of Saw is not over yet. They keep, you know, every time a movie comes out, it's like, it's the final chapter. It's, you know, but that's, they're not going to let that thing die.
I mean, I think that the final chapter of Friday the 13th was what, part 4?
Yeah. Right. They're like, Freddy's dead.
Yeah.
Well, every time they say it's the end, it's not.
Yeah. And we're at exactly. Almost 20 years of Saw, right? Because Saw came out in 2003.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, you got to do something for the 20th anniversary, at least.
I know. I mean, they got to at least make it to Saw 10 so they can have like this skull and crossbones with the X, you know, like
not severed fingers. Making
exactly.
X,
yes. Yes. Perfect. You're hired.
Well, I mean, you can't do what Friday the 13th did and stop at 12. You know, I mean, we're still waiting on the 13th one of that.
And, you know, the fans, there's a certain like group of fans that, like they're not standing on convention. They're not going to pick it apart too much. They just want a rollicking good time in the theater. They want jump scares. They want scream. So it's okay if some of the Saw movies, if the you know, the writers at Variety and Hollywood Reporter go, this is the 15th Saw movie. You know, that's fine. There's people out there that just enjoy it and God bless them. I can't believe, you know, it's fantastic that we found an audience for that stuff. And, you know, I won't stop until they'll have to pry that franchise away from my cold, dead hands. And then they can put my cold, dead hands on the poster.
At this point, people are going to the Saw movies for the traps. It's kind of like the Final Destination movies.
Right.
That's the same movie, but you go for these creative, you know, death inspired kill scenes.
Right.
People are going for the traps at this point. So as long as the production designers and whoever makes up the traps, the Saw, I think it's going to keep going on.
And and you have to be a part of it. I mean, it's like watching a Friday the 13th movie without Henry Benfreddy, you know?
Right.
But yeah. You can't do that.
I'm 100% on board, you know, and when the producers are like, you're not going anywhere, are you, dude? You're not moving to Australia or doing anything silly like that. I'm like, don't worry. You'll always know where to find me.
At least you'll have a piece of it for the Hello to Zep theme that they have to keep using at this point.
At this point, if the movie got to the final 5 minutes and that little dulcimer jangly thing didn't start up, people would be like, that's it. I want my money back.
They wouldn't know it was ending. They'd be like, oh, okay, no, there's more.
Yeah. Or you wouldn't be able to go to bed without it.
Yeah, exactly. The credits are rolling and they're like, oh, no, this isn't done yet.
Yeah. There must be a post-credit scene with the Hello Zep music in it.
Cool. Charlie, thank you very much for spending your morning with us. This has been a great talk.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It's always fun.
So, we're going to get out of here. Our theme song is by Restless Spirit, so check them out. Our artwork is by Chris Fisher. Check him out. Charlie, where can our listeners find you on the social media, you know, if they want to know what's next for Charlie Clouser?
That's a good question. Don't have an Instagram, kind of have a Facebook. I think it's still active. Haven't tweeted in a few months.
To Saw movies.
Coming to Saw movies and check IMDb. If there's anything in the works, it'll say in production at the top of my IMDb page.
Right, fair enough. You can find the other three of us at the Eye on Horror Facebook page, the Eye on Horror Twitter, the Eye on Horror Instagram, the Eye on Horror Letterboxd, I think we have, right, Korea?
I just make lists on my personal one. And we post a bit more frequently than Charlie does.
Yeah.
Good. Not that much more, but we're getting there.
And you can also find us at ihorror.com, which is where we all write, some more than others. But yeah, that's where we all call home. So again, Charlie, thank awesome. You very much. And yeah, thank you. We Thanks, are man. Out of here. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
I'm Jonathan Correa.
And I'm Charlie Clouser.
Keep your eye on horror.